Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome one and all to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Daniel Foster of National Review Online. And for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. As our listeners probably expect, much of our commentary today will be in reaction to the latest Republican presidential debate, this time Rick Perry involved. This one at the Reagan Library and hosted by MSNBC and Politico. Rick Perry, clearly the focal point of the moderators, probably got as much time, him and Mitt Romney, as the rest of them combined and then some. And this seemed to be the key issue that got the moderators fired up, not so sure the rest of the candidates, but definitely got the chattering classes talking in the wake of the debate.
And it is a monstrous lie. It is a Ponzi scheme to tell our kids that are 25 or 30 years old today, you're paying into a program that's going to be there. Anybody that's for the status quo with Social Security today is involved with a monstrous lie to our kids, and it's not right.
And, of course, others jumped on that, perhaps mainly over the fact that he says he never would have had Social Security in the first place. I think most conservatives, if they're honest with themselves, would probably say that if they could go back to the mid-1930s, they wouldn't do it like that. But all of them, I think, agree that it pretty much is a Ponzi scheme. Some just aren't willing to call it that. The money probably won't be there for younger workers. I think overall, Dan, it was a decent night for Perry and Romney because neither really hurt themselves. It seems like the moderators clearly tried to distinguish them. I think Gingrich and others did a good job of reminding everyone that anyone on that stage would be a huge improvement over Barack Obama. So I think overall, while some candidates probably feel like they got short shrift, it was a decent night for Republicans, despite the best efforts of Brian Williams and John Harris.
Yeah, I think Perry did something really shrewd there, which was that he doubled down on the rhetoric. In other words, he took a lot of heat for the Ponzi scheme line, and he didn't back down from it. He doubled down on the rhetoric. But later, in response to a follow-up question, he actually kind of softened his position, made it a little more palatable to, say, you know, moderate voters or senior citizens when he said, look, nobody's going to relitigate the 1930s. We'd have too tough of a time doing that, so it's irrelevant. The important thing is we fix the program, make it sustainable, and make sure that it is no longer that monstrous lie, as he put it. So that was a kind of great way of having it both ways on that answer. Romney took a different tack, which is that he came, you know, right up front and said, tens of millions of people depend on Social Security. We need to save it. The Republicans have always believed in some sort of social safety net. So really, there's this kind of wager, this kind of bet being made by Perry and Romney about how much of the primary electorate is going to say, we like our Social Security checks just fine, thank you, and how much of the electorate is going to be of a mind with Perry and a lot of the more vocal elements of the Tea Party, which is that, let's call a spade, this thing's a mess, and it wasn't a good idea in the first place. And they've taken both sides of that wager, and in a sense, I think that could be the whole ball game in a 1-2 race that's likely to be as tight as it currently looks.
I think it's interesting that both of them, you know, were going after each other about their job creation records, saying that, you know, they weren't as good as their predecessors. Michael Dukakis even got thrown in there at one point.
That was a fun exchange.
It was. So I think the most important thing to point out is that both did a much better job of fostering job creation than the current president of the United States. And you mentioned the social safety net before. Much later in the debate, I think, when a lot of people's kind of glazed over, except for those of us who get paid to follow these sorts of things all the way to the bitter end, Brian Williams brought up this story of Lyndon Johnson as a teacher noticing hungry kids in school and saying that, you know, he would always make it a goal if he ever got into a position of authority that he would make sure the government paid for that kid to have food. And so he asked Ron Paul, who, of course, is very much a limited government conservative / libertarian, you know, is that the government's role? And I think Ron Paul's answer here not only was a great response to that question, but also was a great prebuttal to what the president's likely to say tonight about the Republicans being heartless, you know, towards vital social programs when it comes to balancing the budget at a time of an attempt to create some jobs. So here was Ron Paul's reaction to that issue raised by Brian Williams.
Don't always try to turn around and say that we who believe in liberty, we lack compassion. because we who believe in liberty and understand the market, we're the only ones that really understand how people are taken care of, how they are fed, and how people have jobs. It's the market. It's never the government that does it. So this whole idea that there's something wrong with people who don't lavish out free stuff from the federal government somehow aren't compassionate enough.
Dan, that's one of the most articulate rebuttals of the Democratic agenda I think I've heard in a really long time.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Ron Paul played his role quite nicely. Occasionally he said, dipped into crazy land, as he's wont to do, and, you know, said things like 9/11 was caused by too much government. Nobody even batted an eyelash at that one, which is what I almost better than him saying it is the fact that none of the moderators and nobody else on stage thought there was, you know, took the time even to rebut it because it came from Ron Paul. But you're right. He is a great spokesman, I think, for a lot of the foundational principles that the Paul crowd and mainstream conservatives share. And it's true. I mean, there's this assumption anything worth doing is worth getting the government involved in. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that we want, and not to go too far afield here, but this is why I've always appreciated the truth and response, especially from guys like Senator DeMint, who always makes this point that social conservatism requires fiscal conservatism and vice versa. Because if you want a small government and you want a government without massively overreaching powers, then you'd better have really strong civil institutions outside of government, strong families, but also a strong charitable sphere, a strong social safety net that isn't underwritten by the power to tax, and churches, strong churches, things like that. And so conservatives believe in that sort of thing. Liberals would like to believe that all they ever have to do to make sure that the hungry are fed and the oceans stop rising is check the right box in the voting booth. And I think conservatives understand that there's a whole lot more to getting the kind of world we want to live in than that. And one last thing I'll say, just to kiss up to my boss, Rich Lowry, is there was just a little piece. I forget what the source was here in New York, but there was a little piece about the work he does with the Bowery Mission, which is a group that works with the homeless and also with just at-risk young men. And he, you know, the editor-in-chief of National Review Magazine spends his Wednesdays tutoring kids and young adults in math and reading so they can get their GEDs. So, I mean, he's given us heartless conservatives a bad name.
Oh, there you go. Well, anybody who knows Rich Lowry is not going to be surprised by that, but it's great to point that out, certainly. On to the bad martini, and we stay with the debate and just MSNBC's efforts to basically make Rick Perry and Mitt Romney the centerpiece. And given the polls, that's understandable to a point, but it really looked like the other six were up there for window dressing. Even folks in double digits, like Ron Paul, like Michelle Bachmann, who didn't really have a great performance, I thought. They really seemed to ignore the people on the ends, with the exception of their favorite candidate, John Huntsman, who seemed to be in there almost as much as the guys up in the 20% range. And then questions like, you know, name a few scientists who hold your position on global warming, and trotting out Jose Diaz-Balart from Telemundo because apparently Brian Williams and John Harris aren't capable of asking a question about border security. It just really seemed like this was an effort to manufacture an outcome rather than letting it play out.
Yeah, it was in every respect a MSNBC debate. And you're right about Huntsman, and my colleague Kate Trinko did a piece a couple of weeks ago that pointed out that the standard for being included in the debate was that the candidate had polled at least 4% in one of a certain number of specified national polls. And we sort of were sitting around a news meeting one morning and said, well, that's a funny number, 4%. What's the deal with 4%? Why not 5%? That seems a more natural round figure, or something else, anything else. And so Kate did a little looking into it, and she found out that John Huntsman had polled at his highest 4% in a single poll this year, one poll, thereby just including him in the debate. And based on the number of questions that he got and the amount of airtime he got yesterday, you have to wonder which came first there, the chicken or the egg. Did they, you know, I don't want to hurl accusations around, but it does seem funny to me that this guy who polled exactly one time at a career high of 4% managed to squeak in based on Politico and MSNBC standards for who could be in the debate. And you're right. I mean, Michelle Bachmann did have a bad debate. I think she needed to speak up and interject and insert herself into the conversation more than she did. Look, she wasn't my first choice in this primary, but it does scare me insofar as the mainstream media more or less, they gave her a lot of juice when she had juice. They gave her a lot of airtime when the story was what what thing is Michelle Bachmann going to say next? And now that she's taken a bit of a dip after Ames, they're all but ignoring her. So this was on display. You know, on display last night was the power of the media to both create and destroy candidates and to really shape to a great extent the race to come. I mean, it's a feedback loop, right? Her poll numbers dip, she gets less airtime. Her poll numbers dip more, she gets even less airtime. You know, you can see that sort of thing playing out. Now, I don't think this is over. There's a lot of room for reversals and stuff like that, but that's the dynamic I saw last night.
Dan, on to Martini number three now. And what we saw last night a lot in the debate was Republican ideas for job creation. Perry and Romney certainly talking about their records and what they were able to do as governor and what they did in the private sector, certainly from Romney's perspective. Of course, we're going to hear from the president tonight about his job creation ideas. One of the states, and really one of the largest economies in the world, is really in dire straits economically, and that, of course, is the state of California. And it's interesting now that Democrats are back fully in charge of that state, how they're spending their time. During the summer legislative session, the Democratic-controlled legislature has debated what color of airsoft guns, what color they should be painted, the types of sheets hotels can use, and the best of all, babysitter regulations. Now, according to this story, some of the required regulations being bandied about for babysitters include regular 10-minute breaks, vacation time, workers' comp, 30-minute lunch breaks, as well as overtime, basically meaning parents would have to hire two babysitters so they could stagger their work schedule so the kids aren't left unattended for those 30-minute lunch breaks. I mean, then, of course, in San Francisco, their biggest issue apparently in recent days has been to force the nudists in certain neighborhoods of San Francisco to put down clothing or towels when they're at these outdoor restaurants, which just raises a whole host of questions about how we ever got to that point in San Francisco. But this is where the Democrats are focusing their attention right now.
Yeah, you have California, which is the left coast, and San Francisco, which is the left coast of the left coast. And you're right, these stories keep – and it's not just that. We did a little item here at National Review a few weeks ago on San Francisco's intention to ban the sale of puppies and kittens within – the city. So this is supposed to be the freest loving city and the freest loving state in the union. And we've got babysitters on workman's comp. You can't buy your kid a puppy, and you take him to a restaurant, and you might run into a couple of nudists with a little tea towel under their rear ends. Yeah, I do think it's interesting. And what I'm always reminded of when these stories come out is these fear pieces when Perry entered the race about what if the whole country were run like Texas? We'd all be shooting wolves from helicopters with crossbows. Well, you know what? That sounds a lot more appealing to me than if the entire country were run like San Francisco.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good standard to go by. And just remember, you know, who they love in Congress, and that would be Nancy Pelosi. So
I always have to say this. Never forget that for 4 years, the person third in line to the presidency was selected by 75% of 75% of San Francisco.
That's unbelievable and amazing that we even survived. Let's hope we don't ever go back to that place again. Dan, thanks for pinch hitting for Jim. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Dan Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.